Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
The celebration is on. It's still theirs until someone rips it out of their hands.
Hello and welcome back to the PLL Happy Hour podcast alongside Chris Rosenthal. I'm Kevin Brown for Inside Lacrosse. Rosie, it's quarterfinal week. Boy, we got a special guest on the podcast today. How you feeling, and how pumped are you for some elimination games?
Can't wait for the games. The drama gets cranked up a notch. It's always kind of a mixed blessing time of the season because it's going to be, you know, super excitement times 100, but then also the agony of defeat, all these people going home, half these teams having their hearts broken. We are getting ready to get on this emotional roller coaster, and yeah, let's go.
Now we're getting on this roller coaster together, fans, so make sure you keep with us as we follow along with all the action. As is the case each season, this is the season's superlatives podcast, Rosie. The end of season awards nominations have just been unveiled by the league this week. We'll get your thoughts on that in just a second. We usually do this podcast right after the conclusion of the regular season. Last week's kind of epic finales with the Redwoods, Whipsnakes, and the Water Dogs clinching the final three spots for the postseason. It was just too much to fit into one podcast, Rosie. So we had Phil Shore on last week. We'll have a special podcast that we mentioned later on for today as you're listening. And Rosie, before we get into these very distinguished IL categories, any thoughts on the end of season awards nominations? Team, what about this guy?
Well, I think we got to start one place, of course, and to no surprise, really, probably at this point, there's legitimately no reason Brett Dobson wasn't nominated for Goalie of the Year. I think you just look at his numbers, his consistency throughout the season. It really just, it's surprising. You got to wonder what everyone else was thinking by kind of leaving him off there. And by everybody else, I mean the players who do the voting for this. You would think that somebody with the kind of resume he's put together, not just this season, but, you know, kind of the rep he has built for himself over these past couple of years, would kind of be in a much higher spot, I guess, amongst his peers, because that's really, I guess, what this comes down to. You know, if you want to talk snub, you got to talk about the rest of the league apparently thinks he was not a top three goalie this year. So, you know, I find that surprising, or a top four, because, you know, all these positions don't necessarily have three nominees. So I'm not sure why they cut off the bar where they did for, you know, not even to say he was the fourth one. I don't know. Maybe he was the sixth picked guy. I don't know the numbers, how they played out. But I was very surprised not to see him. I honestly thought he might win it all this season, just based on the consistency of his performances. But I'm clearly very wrong, and the players felt very differently about it. What did you think there?
Yeah, well, before we get to my thought, you know, the first rule of team what about is taking another guy off. So as you mentioned, 8-team league, three nominees, as is the case for the face-off position as well as, you know, LSM. But listen, Rosie, these guys only get three. Liam Entsman gets the last spot. Rookie Logan McNaney and Blaze Reardon were probably shoo-ins. And Entsman gets the nod over Dobson. Would you have liked to see Dobson over Entsman?
Well, here's the thing. To the best of my knowledge, at least, you can have as many you want up there. You know what I mean? Like, you can add another one. It's different from, say, an all-star game where they're like, you know, we got to have these three guys starting at attack. And then you say, well, I want these other two guys starting attack as well. And so then you find yourself in that dilemma where, you know, you can't have five starting attackmen or something like that. But I don't think you would have been run up against any sort of opposition to just have him up there as well.
Yeah, I wrote about the snubs a little bit as the nominees were announced on Monday morning. Yeah, Dobson's a glaring one. Utah finishes in last place. They missed the postseason. That's probably the most likely reason why. Bo Pettersson, also not included in the D-Mid of the Year award. But, you know, the Boston Cannons, they get some nominees. Matt Campbell for Midfielder of the Year. And Ajax Apatela probably had a good shout for Defensive Player of the Year, leading the league in caused turnovers for the best defense in terms of scores against per game. So it's also interesting, you look at the rookies of the year, pretty stacked class when all things were said and done. We'll get to that a little bit later as well. And, you know, Andrew McAdory's up for Midfielder of the Year. Dylan Hess is up for D-Mid of the Year. Neither up for Rookie of the Year as rookies themselves. Kind of shows you the depth of that category. Chris Kavanaugh, probably the front runner, as we mentioned last podcast. Most Valuable Player. We have a question for our podcast guest that he answers somewhat diplomatically when it comes to the MVP award. So we'll get to that in a little bit. But yeah, I liked your answer there with the biggest snub of Brett Dobson there. Yeah, and then, you know, we got our first round matchups here. Quarterfinal weekend, Rosie. You know, before we get to these season superlatives, everyone better be getting their butts in sofas Saturday night, August 23rd. The action gets underway at 6 p.m. Eastern at TCO Stadium in Minneapolis, where the Philadelphia Water Dogs will take on the Maryland Whipstinks with a chance to take on the New York Atlas in the semis. Right after that concludes, maybe have some time to warm up, of course. Carolina Chaos versus the California Redwoods, scheduled for 8:30 p.m. Both games on at ESPN+. Rosie, very exciting games, which we'll get to in the end of the podcast here. But first, are you mad at me? I feel like, I don't know where your college lacrosse alliances lie. I do know where they lie for women's lacrosse. You are a noted Syracuse Orange fan. We're recording this Tuesday night. I just published the way ahead mock draft. Shout out BLL's Adam Lamberti for beating me to the punch last week. And, you know, it's a tough draft to mock up. I had Utah Archers selecting Mikey Weisar from Towson instead of maybe your boy Joyce Bellina. What's your take on the whole situation?
You know, you did touch on it from a Syracuse angle. And yes, I am a ride or die Syracuse women's lacrosse fan. It just so happens I am also, in fact, a ride or die Syracuse men's lacrosse fan. Big fan of all things orange. So now I will say this. Obviously, there was the thought that perhaps we do see Joyce Bellina go very early, perhaps number one. That was before we knew the precise draft order. And, you know, I've been reading what you wrote, lay down some compelling cases as to why maybe Bates goes in a different direction here. And I do think another thing that kind of helps out this case here is Chris Bates always seems to roll with a particular idea and understanding of what he wants and what he thinks his organization needs. And it's not necessarily going to be, you know, maybe the guy who scores the most points or maybe the number one guy at this position or that position. I think he's been very good at taking the whole bird's eye view and figuring it out from what his specific organization is going to need the next year and years down the road. So if that guy is not, in fact, Joey Spallina, then, you know, I'm gonna listen to you on this one. And we will see how things play out. But yeah, no, look, you laid on some compelling cases that everybody should read. So get over into InsideLacrosse.com and read it and then share it and all that stuff. But yeah, you know, I was thinking, you know, Joyce Belina goes number one or something like that, maybe number two. Syracuse becoming once again a pro lacrosse factory. I think we've seen that this year. So we'll see how it all plays out. But yeah, I'm not totally surprised by it. You know, Bates oftentimes maybe goes in a different direction than what some other people might have thought.
Yeah, appreciate the compliments, Rosie. Basically, the crux of it for these purposes, I really couldn't see Bates supplanting Matt Moore at attack. When you got Sam King coming back, you know, we saw him play some midfield earlier in the season, kind of settled an attack when Matt Moore went down. They've got two lefties right now who underperformed with Mac O'Keefe and Connor Fields. If Grant Ament can't beat out Matt Moore for that righty spot, it's interesting to project where Joey Spallina fits in that situation, right? Now, if he scores 100 points, wins the Tourton and a national championship, you got to take him number one, right? And if he does all that, you can bet the kitchen sink that or you can bet the house that Joe Spallina, his father, is trading the kitchen sink for his services with the California Redwoods. That being said, Rosie, that's all we have for this look ahead to next season. You know, the draft order is not even set yet. We will have time to talk about it in the off season here. So let's do more of a recap of the season as we approach, and there's no better way to start than the best team. There's 2 7-3 choices, two teams who are not playing this weekend, two teams who earn their right for a semifinal berth, and that is the Denver Outlaws and the New York Atlas. Rosie, which team do you think had the best regular season?
I'm going to give it to the New York Atlas. Coming off of last season, just to, I think, building off of that kind of momentum, obviously didn't get all the way to the championship last year, but put down a rack of wins, really kind of started to see this offense come into shape with the superstars they have there, then kind of carrying it on this season and in evolving it a little bit more, not having one guy do quite as much, kind of spreading it out. You got some midfielders doing some more scoring this season, bringing some rookies at different positions who can excel. You know, you're bringing like Michael Grace, and kind of the flexibility that they've been afforded there is maybe something that last season or seasons prior, they wouldn't have been able to as smoothly kind of continue their success. So yeah, you just look at the roster top to bottom, just kind of stacked at all positions. So yeah, I am going to go ahead and give it to them. New York Atlas team of the year. What says you?
I'll go Denver Outlaws then with the season that they had, the head-to-head win over New York in a game that we'll touch on in a couple categories here. Just the sheer firepower is creating a level of buzz and excitement around the league in terms of fandom. Like when the Denver Outlaws play each weekend, you've got to watch their game. Right, Pat Cavanaugh, Brennan O'Neill, Logan Wisnauskas, and the biggest free agent get in league history, Jaron Bernhardt, coming off the game winner about 3 years ago, it feels like at this point, in that Week 10 finale, or their regular season finale against the Atlas. So, yeah, Rosie, I'll go with them, and I'll kind of combine this with our next category of best coach for a lot of the reasons that I'll steal from you over the season that you've lauded the work Tim Sudan has done as general manager. You know, convincing Jaron Bernhardt was really just the culmination of a lot of offseason moves, including trading for Pat Kavanaugh when he wanted out of Boston, drafting McNaney when we thought there were other holes to maybe fill. He's like, no, I want my upstate boy in between the pipes. And he gets in there after Owen McElroy drops his first two starts. Look where he is now, 7-1 as the starter. So Tim Sudan is my coach of the year, I think, pick.
I think you kind of have to just, you know, along the same lines, you have the two teams. They're 7-win teams. You have the one coach that led one team to it. So, of course, you got to give the shout-out to the other one who did a pretty good job as well, Mike Pressler. Obviously not a splashy pickup the same way you had your Bernhardt pickup there. But I feel like his game has been more, tortoise than hare, right? Kind of putting these pieces brick by brick together, you know, making the Schellenberger pick that paid off quite well for him this year, you know, bringing in the guys this year, like I just kind of previously mentioned, some success on some rookies, making some kind of tricky, lineup decisions that, you know, maybe some people might not have seen coming. He's got a lot to juggle there. But he has everything he's been doing this season as far as kind of juggling guys in and out of the lineup, you know, moving guys to protect your rosters, benching certain guys here and there. It all has been working out pretty well for him so far.
Now, one category I think has a little more competition than people realize. I think a lot of people have a shoe-in for this category. Best play slash, I think it kind of becomes the best goal of the season, more or less, right? What's your best play of the 2025 season?
So I'm going to skip the, I think the one that we initially sort of thought I was going to go with, and I'm going to go with Ryder Garnsey's goal there. End of the season, Ryder Garnsey goal in Boston. And the reason why I'm going to pick this one over what I initially was going to pick was because of the context to it. Just because you don't get a lot of plays that serve as kind of a way to do something in addition to just the scoring itself. And you throw it. Look, so I'll start with this. The goal itself was pretty impressive, right? You do that kind of one-handed, whatever you call it, that Ryder Garnsey does, throws that nonsense in there, then presence of mind to tell the crowd to shut up, which is just fantastic. I appreciate having the, you know, presence to turn to that crowd that had been going nuts, cheering their team on, getting ready to go to the playoffs, you know, championship ambitions. And he just, I think, thrived on ruining everybody's day in that entire stadium. So armed with the context behind it, kind of that wind in his sails, I'm going to give that goal to Ryder Garnsey as the play of the year.
Now, because you didn't outwardly say it, and I alluded to it, the goal that I thought you were going to choose was the Brennan O'Neill between the legs against the Boston Cannons. Well, you've seen it. If you're listening to this podcast, you know what we're talking about. One-handed grab between the legs, straight up nastiness. Probably didn't need to, but like the Clark breakdown is the poor pass that kind of led him to do it. And listen, it led to one of the quotes of the season post game. He's like, if it hits my stick, I got to catch. And it turned out to be one of the best goals of the season. Another one I'll throw out there that I think doesn't get enough shine is that Matt Trainer BTB down the alley against the Whip Snakes when they were just absolutely crushing early in Villanova Stadium. Like, to get that much power, like, that far down the alley and to ping it that hard into the top left, definitely deserves some more love there. You mentioning the Redwoods Boston Cannons playoff implications, I think deserves more love for this next category. Best game. In my mind, I thought it was between Cannons Outlaws, that 18-17 35 goal shootout that had just a straight up SportsCenter top 10 carousel to it. 10 like BTBs pretty much in succession, it felt like, including that goal of the year in most people's minds. Or the Outlaws versus Atlas from week 10, which I alluded to as well. Are you throwing California and Boston into that?
No, I'm going with Outlaws Cannons. Like you mentioned, the 10 BTBs had a Jules Hennenberg two-pointer never seen before, and who knows if we will see again. And also just putting it on ABC, just kind of like an event sort of game. You know, I mean, we've had a few since then, but it was kind of like, you know, hey, check out this big stage game we're going to have this afternoon. And it was kind of one of those perfect storm things, right? You know, it was like a middle of the afternoon, could have gotten everybody around to watch it. Who knows how many bars all over the place have that game on. And if that's like your first exposure to lacrosse, you know, what a great first impression. You're like, wow, these guys are awesome. Look at all this stuff they can do. You know, that was such a high flying game. So many, you know, unorthodox moves and just kind of plays that were just high impact and fast, and it was highly contested. It was kind of pretty much everything you could ask for. So that one still gets my vote for the overall award. And tough go for the Cannons. I just noticed this when we were talking about the goal of the year. Like, all of these were on the Cannons. That is a tough go for them. Tough season for the Boston Cannon.
Yeah, you know, the Leroy Jenkins, Marcus Holman dive, actually taking them out of the number one pick, another kind of against their favor this season. You know, you mentioned the run of ABC games. It goes Cannons Outlaws, a couple weekends later, Outlaws Atlas, which is probably my pick because it was the best two teams of the season. You know, Schellenberger has that goal to tie it up with 15 seconds left. Jared Bernhardt wins in overtime. Everything you want in a lacrosse game in there. But honestly, like, this game really didn't have as much meaning. But Atlas versus Water Dogs, 20-19 from this past weekend, also an ABC game. The high scoring game ever in league history, 39 scores. And just a battle between some good MVP candidates. You know, the Atlas had to hold off Philadelphia late kind of flurry there. So it kind of did seem a little more interesting than it actually was. But kudos to that game as well. And, you know, we're probably not allowed to talk about our MVP votes quite yet, Rosie, if we get them. But I do want to introduce a very special podcast guest. You know it. You know him as the leading scorer of the 2025 regular season, 2021 national champion at the NCAA level. Let's welcome on Connor Schellenberger onto the podcast. And we now welcome on New York Atlas attackman Connor Schellenberger onto the show. Connor, thanks for joining.
Appreciate you guys having me on.
No, Connor, we're in the midst of playoff week here, previewing a couple of games you are not involved in, but you will have a heavy eye on the first game here between the Eastern Conference foes, the Philadelphia Water Dogs against the Maryland Whipsnakes, and, you know, we're sprinkling in some season superlatives in here and there, so... First off, just big picture, what's it been like from rookie season to the year two here for you?
It's been fun. It's hard to believe. It's midway through August already, and, you know, kids are going back to school and all that stuff. But, you know, I feel like the summer always flies by. But this has been a fun summer for sure. And, you know, I think one of the fun things this summer has just been how much better our team has gotten throughout the summer. And, you know, last year I feel like we started off so hot, and it's hard to kind of maintain that level of play, you know, over 3 or 4 months. And, you know, this summer we started out a little slow, but I feel like we've kind of gotten better each week we've been playing, and you know, that's always fun to be a part of, because you still feel like you got your best lacrosse out there.
You know, you mentioned getting off to a hot start last year. You know, you yourself, very hot start, kind of, you know, we hear a lot about a rookie kind of having a slow start or kind of getting adjusted to the game, but you come out right away with an 8-point game. What do you remember about that experience, you know, maybe the week leading up to the first game and then, you know, finally getting out there on the pro level?
Gosh, yeah, that was a crazy week. I mean, I remember losing, I think it was Saturday in Philly against Maryland. And then, you know, you go home, you pack up all your stuff out of your apartment. And, you know, I was kind of hoping to milk it as long as I could, you know, getting up to training camp, honestly, just, you know, I needed a little bit of separation and process everything. And, you know, I remember hanging out with some of the guys and I got the phone call from Coach Presley, like, hey, you're going to be here tomorrow, essentially. And next thing you know, my flight was booked and, yeah, I was up there Monday, and then, you know, they flew us private back to D.C., which was pretty cool. I think it was Wednesday, and then, you know, back to Albany on Thursday or Friday and playing the next day. So, yeah, that week was such a whirlwind. But honestly, I think that helped kind of that first week playing-wise, just because you don't have time to overthink anything. We were so busy, so it was like, you know, just kind of just go out there and play.
That's the thing, too, like, right? Like, you're coming right off the Final Four, a brilliant career at Virginia. You're the number two pick, obviously, for Atlas. So you've got some expectations on you, and you've got some team roles for yourself to kind of fulfill. And you're walking right in there. You're coming off 4 years of college. Like, how much better of rephrasing, how much more well-rested and just healthier overall have you felt this summer?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's the biggest thing. I mean, I'll be honest, when people have asked me this summer, just like, you know, how is it? Like, are you having fun and all that stuff? And I honestly say, like, it's been so much more fun this summer, just, you know, not coming off that full college season. And just like, you know, I'm not saying this is just me, but like everyone's feeling this way. Like, I think Pat missed a bunch of games last year, and, you know, I'm sure Brendan had a bunch of things, but all these guys, like, it's just so hard with the level of playing college these days, you know, playing for 6 months and then, you know, playing for another 3 or 4 months against, you know, the best players in the world. So, yeah, this summer's been a lot more fun, just having full off season, kind of like catch your breath a little bit and you know, heal up, but also have a little time to like get better and do all those good things.
We're talking about, you know, playing at the University of Virginia. Obviously have to do shout out, diving a little bit more to the great state of Virginia itself. Tell me about the origin story, how you got involved playing lacrosse, rising to the level that you did that ultimately got you suited up for the Cavaliers.
Yeah, so my uncle played at Randolph-Macon in Virginia. He played football and lacrosse, and, you know, my parents had never really played. I think my mom played like maybe a year in high school or something, and my dad had never heard of it. So just going to my uncle's games at Randolph-Macon, I think that's when I was first introduced to it. And yeah, you're right, obviously growing up near UVA, it was easy for me to become a UVA lacrosse fan when they were so good during those, you know, 2000 years, really, in 2010s. And then I feel like this is well documented, but I love watching Steele Stanwyck play, and, you know, he was kind of like my idol growing up. So yeah, it was so fun going to those games growing up, and I think that's kind of what fueled my love for lacrosse.
It is funny to hear about that, you know, with your kind of admiration for Steele, he being a Cavalier legend himself, you know, you being a very local product. Just I've said this on the podcast because, you know, Connor, you and I have talked kind of extensively offline and for other article interviews, just like the evolution of your game. I've said on this podcast that it's been, one, you're a lethal high school shooter. I think it's been, you used the phrase well documented there, that you were just like taking loads of high school practice shots, and even before then, to hone that skill in. And then you've kind of become this cerebral quarterback. Once you got to Virginia, and maybe the later stages of your high school career, but especially under Sean Kerwin, is that kind of progression accurate?
Yeah, definitely. It's and I think you're 100% right with, like, you know, the people behind it. And I really have to give all the credit to Coach Kerwin. You know, the 4 years I got to spend with him, I mean, you know, I know Xander Dixon was on a podcast the other day, and he was saying buy stock in Dartmouth, and I'm 100% doing the same thing. I mean, I think he's the smartest coach in college lacrosse, and, you know, I would do anything for him. He gave so much to me and helped me develop so much over my time. And then I think also just the guys I was playing with. I mean, you know, in high school, you have guys and roles and stuff like that. But, you know, I feel like naturally guys tend to score more goals and are more of shooters maybe. But, you know, working with Coach Kerwin and showing up to UVA and being able to play with, you know, now the best off-ball player in the world. And, you know, before this past year, the best goal scorer of all time. Like, you know, why am I shooting when those guys are shooting 50, 60% at times and never seem to miss? So I think it's really just a credit to those guys and the coaches that I've had. And, you know, they've kind of helped me transform into that.
Well, one more, Rosie, just to piggy off that, like, you know, you mentioned Coach Kerwin, you had your assistant at STAB, Coach Nate Rollman, taking all these shots with yourself and your dad, right? Just this relationship with your dad that you form of, like, you mentioned it, he's never played lacrosse in his life, and he's kind of helping you form into this player that you are today. Just give them their flowers and just how they've kind of helped you, especially with your kind of work ethic to get to here.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's definitely where it all starts. I mean, just their willingness to drive me to DC when I was younger, and, you know, that, like, work ethic and really just, like, selflessness by my parents, you know, kind of motivated me in a way, honestly. Like, you know, they're willing to sacrifice their whole nights after they worked from 7 a.m. to 3 or 4 p.m. to sit in DC traffic and, you know, spend all this money for me to play Mad Lax and all these crazy things. Then on top of that, my dad's willing to go out and practice with me, or, you know, my mom's willing to do all these things for me. So that was honestly the most rewarding thing at UVA, was just, you know, having them right there with me. And, you know, they're the whole reason all of this is even possible. And, yeah, a lot of this is definitely for them, and, just their work ethic, you know, and their own daily lives and their own work, you know, still inspires me to this day. So I'm thankful that I get to see that from them on a daily basis.
You mentioned Xander and his off ball play. And of course, you know, you got a third guy in that lineup as well, Jeff Teat, holding his own as well over there. Just two incredibly different attackmen, you know, who bring very unique skill sets to the table, but obviously both thrive at what they do. Can you recall one moment from each of them this season that, you know, obviously your teammate and play with them, but even still, there's got to be some times where you sit back and are kind of, holy crap, I can't believe they just did what they did out there. Does anything immediately jump to your mind as a memory of either of them doing something that just, even in real time, kind of blew you away?
Yeah, there's a bunch of stuff like that. I mean, yeah, really, whenever we step on the field, and I mean, I will say, like, the whole last year, I was feeling that way, like, you know, watching Jeff and what he was doing, it literally looked like he was playing a video game on easy mode. And I think Xander, you know, just the passes he catches and handles, and, you know, the shooting angles that he's able to release it from and behind the back. I mean, all this stuff, it's just like, you know, no other player in the world can do what he does. And, you know, a lot of times, like, the guy throwing the ball gets a lot of the credit. And it's like, I literally had to do nothing there. I just put it anywhere near him, and he catches and finishes it. And, you know, Jeff's the same way. Like, the way I like to talk about him is, like, you have this guy who's the MVP, who's, you know, can beat a guy one-on-one, who can shoot from 10 to 13 yards, whatever. But he's also, like, one of the best off-ball players in the world as well. So, I mean, he has no weakness. And, you know, just getting to play with those two, it's like, you know, I kind of have to pinch myself. It's, you know, it makes all of our lives so easy.
Especially with, you know, You mentioned it, Jeff, playing on easy mode last year, just absolutely shatters the PLL scoring record. You lead the league in scoring this summer with 46 points. You mentioned Pat Brennan, also in your 2024 draft class, just also MVP nominees with the Denver Outlaws, also 7-3. Just what's it been like, that dynamic of, you know, you three kind of coming in with a lot of hype last summer into the pro ranks and kind of delivering in your sophomore season, sir?
It's been fun. I think it's, you know, it's cool to be around those guys. You know, I feel like think about it or not, we all kind of push each other. And, you know, it's hard at times just because, you know, Brennan's so good and Pat's so good. And it's like, you know, we're all kind of fighting for the same championships, you know, at the same time, it feels like. And, you know, it kind of eats at you a little bit more when one of the other ones, you know, wins one. But, you know, I think that's what makes it fun. And that's why we all, you know, love playing and love competing and all that stuff. So, yeah, it's cool to get to play along those guys and, you know, honestly, just watch them play sometimes. It's, you know, some of the stuff that they do is pretty crazy.
I want to go back to another one of your teammates real quick. You know, we mentioned Xander and Jeff. I wanted to get your thoughts on Reed Bauer and what he's been doing lately. Earlier, really kind of known and praised for, you know, heavy off-ball stuff, really solid pick work and stuff like that. Past two games, hat tricks in each of them, shooting like 6-for-10. Just what do you think about his performance lately and how it's kind of added to the dimension of the Atlas offense altogether?
Yeah, Reed he's been unbelievable. I mean, he's like the nicest dude ever and one of the most unselfish people you could possibly, you know, be around. And then, you know, you're right. Like, since we've thrown him in the lineup, I think, you know, our offense has been lights out. And again, just like how unselfish he is. I mean, you know, setting off ball picks for guys, setting picks, like, you know, guys in PLL just run through picks a lot of the times. And he literally just is willing to soak them every time. And, you know, a lot of the stuff that he doesn't get credit for, he's probably the best in the world at. But, you know, it's been pretty cool the last couple of weeks, though, to see him score, you know, 4 goals, 3 goals, and actually, you know, get some goals from all of the little things that he does. So, yeah, I mean, Reed he's like the best possible dude you could have in a locker room, and I'm glad he's on our team.
You mentioned it earlier in this appearance with, you know, you started out last year so well. Jeff's breaking records for the All-Star break, and you guys are clinching the number one seed really early on in the season. And this revamped kind of playoff structure, when you're winning 5 straight games, and you finish off the regular season with the highest scoring victory in PLL history. Just what's the momentum like in that locker room, and are you guys peaking at the right time going into the semis?
I mean, I would like to think so. I mean, like, kind of like what I was saying earlier, I think this team's really just focused on getting better every week we can, you know, every practice. You know, Coach Bressler's talked about this a lot, but I feel like our practices before games have been unbelievable this year. I mean, we've kind of ramped it up a little bit, and we're going a little harder, and I think that's been huge. And, you know, Coach Bressler also talks a lot about playing 48 full, and, you know, I think that's gotten us twice this year, where we've had big leads on teams and haven't closed it. And, you know, as much as you don't want to have those things happen and it can't become a trend, you know, those are good learning experiences, especially this time of year and in the playoffs. And, you know, if you lack for 12 minutes or 24 minutes, you know, you're having a long off season. So, yeah, hopefully we can keep putting it all together. And as Coach Pressler says, play 48 full.
And right now, of course, we're sitting where you guys are enjoying this bye week that you earned for the regular season success. How do you and the Atlas approach this bye week where you've got two opponents who are going to be duking it out? Are you kind of scouting for both of them just in case, or are you worrying about yourselves more this week, and then next week you shift into individual focus?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think this week it's definitely been more of a focus on ourselves. You know, we'll practice this weekend, and And I'm sure it'll just be mainly focused on just getting better as a team and as a group. But yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the cool things about the PLL schedule is we play both the Whipsnakes and the Water Dogs twice already this year. So, you know, everyone has a pretty good idea of each other, and you kind of know what to expect. So, yeah, we know, you know, there's no easy games in this league for sure. And you know, whoever we play is going to be a tough game.
A tough game indeed, Connor. And, you know, it's been cool to hear about some of the initiatives the league's been taking this summer to integrate themselves in the home markets a couple weekends before. For yourself, you're in Philadelphia a couple weekends before the semifinals, where the semis will be played this year, historically where the title game is. So a little bit of change up this season, title game in Jersey. Tell us about your schedule a little bit this week and kind of what you've been up to and keeping busy with the league.
Yeah, so we've had a couple guys in Philadelphia, you know, marketing for the league, trying to get as many people out to the semifinals in Philly as possible. And, you know, it's been a fun week so far. We've been to a lot of practices, but we, you know, we've been to some club practices, helping the kids out, which is always fun, you know. Hopefully teach them some things, but also just get to mess around with those guys. And we played some lacrosse in the I might be mispronouncing this, but the Reading Terminal Market today, which that I don't think I ever would have expected, you know, doing that right next to like a fish stand or whatever. But and then yeah, we did some stuff with Harlem Lacrosse, which was awesome. And then I think tomorrow we're doing like a hospital visit and maybe a little tour of the Eagles Stadium. So fun weekend here in Philly, but definitely not gonna be mad to go home for a little bit.
Yeah, I saw a clip of you working with some kids recently, and I think you asked them who their favorite teams were. Very few Atlas fans in it. It seemed like, were they all kind of rooting strictly for the Water Dogs? Is that the feeling you were getting there?
Yeah, definitely. There were definitely a lot of Water Dogs. We're a little bit in enemy territory right now, I think. You know, when the kids saw Xander and I walk up, they were like, that's not ours. So they were a little frustrated, but hopefully we're converting some kids here.
Right. Enemy territory indeed. You know, it's a PLL themed podcast here for Inside Lacrosse, Connor, but I do have to congratulate you on being named the third assistant over at your alma mater. Just one, how cool of an experience is that going to be for you? And just two, I'll get to this next. I'm going to need you to put your coaching cap on next, but how do you expect to kind of integrate yourself as, you know, the program's all-time leader, all-time assister, and now you're going in there just with a bona fide track record to hopefully get some player development going?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's exciting. I mean, I think my role is really just whatever the guys need. I mean, you know, that sounds basic and maybe a little cheesy, but I you know, that's my biggest thing to them is like, you know, I want them to know that they can come to me with literally anything. And you know, obviously on the field that's definitely the case, but also hopefully be that little like younger bridge for them. And like, you know, I was only there 2 or 3 years ago. You know, I could help them out with anything off the field as well. But yeah, really whatever those guys need. And then I also have to give two thank yous and, you know, Coach Tiffany for giving me the opportunity. And then, you know, being able to work with Coach Cassis again was, you know, I couldn't turn that down. And that was a big, big part of the decision. I mean, you know, how much he had an impact on me my final year and, you know, what he was willing to give just like energy wise and emotionally to our team and our offense that final year that I was there. I mean, I was just blown away by like how good of a dude he is and, you know, how much he cares about us. I mean, his family wasn't even in Charlottesville and he was literally there for every single guy, you know, every step of the way on and off the field. Yeah. Being able to work with Coach Tiffany and Coach Cassis is definitely exciting.
I want to jump back to the pros real quick, because every time a team has a bye week, I think the athlete generally gets asked the same question and they say, you know, do you have a preference as far as, you know, which of these two guys you end up facing? I've never heard anybody actually admit that they do, So I'm not even going to bother asking you that, but I am going to ask you this. Yes or no. You don't have to say a name or anything. Just say yes or no if you have one opponent you would like to see when you guys suit up again.
That's a tough one. I think, honestly, no. I mean, real quick, I mean, obviously we have a little bit of a, I wouldn't even call it like a track record with the Whip Snakes just because of what happened last year. But you know, I think this team is just so different and, you know, if anything, just motivated, you know, by what's happened in the past. So, yeah, I honestly don't think we really care.
For an answer, but you know, Connor, we're going to edit that answer whatever way we like for social enough. But you do have a good track record with Ajax, your kind of individual battles going back from Maryland and Virginia days. And, you know, you did have a good performance against him in the game up in Villanova, which you referenced as a learning point for this season. But putting your coach cap on, just as a neutral, this is kind of away from your role as a future opponent. But what's the scout on these guys? What can we expect in this Water Dogs, Whip Snakes quarterfinal here?
It's a good one. I mean, I think the Water Dogs are definitely starting to figure it out a little bit. You know, putting CJ and you know, Sowers and McArdle on the same line, you know, it's starting to look like what everyone thought it would look like and knew it would look like at some point. So, I mean, you know, I would expect them to definitely, you know, be explosive again this week like they were against us. And it's just really a tough offense to match up with and stop. You know, obviously the Whip Snakes have a great defense and, you know, Emmett Carroll's been, he's been awesome in net as well. So that'll be an interesting matchup. And then I'm trying to keep like opinions out of this, but yeah, I think, you know, it's going to be a good game, but I can see it going either way. So, you know, I think we're all looking forward to watching it.
Sounds like 16 to 12 Water Dogs. Is that what we were saying there? We'll go ahead and we'll run with that. Don't worry. We got the software. Let's put that in there for you. Connor, I wanted to ask you this question. I don't know if you've seen this. We've posted it various times in some of our articles. I wanted to get an explanation, a breakdown here. We've seen the locker room appears to be a large Atlas medallion. And I don't know the protocol. I assume it's for the player of the game or something like that. Walk us through the lore. And all I know is the end result. I believe somebody gets up and breaks it down for a minute with a little dance move or something like that. Could you tell us the origin, if you were there for the beginning of that, and how that's been going? Anybody stand out with some particularly solid moves? just tell us what you can tell us about that.
Yeah. I don't know how long it's been around, honestly. But it was there last year, and yeah, it goes to the player of the game. And, you know, I think the cool thing about it is it's not always the guy that scores the most goals. I mean, you know, you could argue Jeff T should have gotten it every week, you know, the past 2 years. But, you know, it goes to kind of everybody who, you know, if it's like gritty ground balls or good defense on, you know, short stick D midi or whatever it is. But, you know, also Entman could probably win every week as well. But, yeah, dance moves. I mean, we play the same song every time. And yeah, I think Rex had a pretty funny one. I don't know if that one got on social media, but like he gives a little dance move and then like,
yeah, it did. You
know, okay, that one was. And then he shoots it to Coach Pressler at the end, which
yep.
Looks pretty funny. But yeah, maybe if we win it, we got to get Coach Pressler the chain and see what he has to offer. That'd be good on social media.
Oh, watch out, man. Watch out. Coach P with the dance moves is a dangerous recipe. No, Connor, we really appreciate you talking to some shop here with us on the Feel Happy Hour podcast. I'll leave you off with this. Just, you know, we've been joking around and whatnot, but just your improvement from year one to year two, just 4 7-point games in many people's eyes. You're one of the leading choices for the MVP this season. Again, a regular season award. So I know you have more to prove this postseason, but just what's slowed down for you? And did you have any exchanges with Jeff of hey, I can't believe the both of us weren't nominated, like Pat and Brennan?
Yeah, I mean, I know Jeff doesn't even like care about that stuff, so honestly,
yeah, totally.
I didn't feel the need to text him, but like, you know, Xander and I have talked about it a bunch, like, you know, we both think Jeff is by far the best player in the world, and you know, we obviously think he should have been up for those, both of those awards, Tacman of the Year and MVP, and yeah, I you know, we don't want to get into all that stuff, but yeah, I mean, we definitely think he should have been up for him, and we think he's the best player in the world for sure, and you know, I think we're both very thankful that we get to play with him. He makes our jobs very easy.
And just for you personally, just from rookie year to year two, just has it really slowed down for you?
Yeah, definitely. I think you know, I think being healthier was honestly a big thing, and just kind of like being able to move how you want to move, that helps everything slow down. And you know, I think the leadership on our team has helped a ton, and I'm not even just saying that's like a cliche thing. I mean, you know, Trevor Baptiste was there for me early in the season after the first week, and you know, it was just like, hey man, like, how are you doing? Like, checking in, like, you know, seeing what was going on, like, you know, what needs to be done to help you feel more comfortable and kind of take that next step. And you know, I'll always be thankful for him, you know, for doing that. And and then again, like, they're just the guys we have on our team, like how unselfish our offense is. I mean, you know, again, this sounds cliche, but you know, it's really true. Like when you bring up guys like Reed Bowering, who are setting these amazing picks and doing all these little things, like, you know, sure, we get on the stat sheet and we get a lot of the credit, but you know, if Matt Trainor isn't throwing the ball through X, like I can't hit Xander on the backside, and all these little things that, you know, maybe don't show up, or you know, the media doesn't, you know, always want to point out on Twitter or whatever it is, but you know, these guys are making the difference here and allowing us to do what we do.
Connor, that is a terrific way to end this podcast appearance. Hopefully all the club coaches and players will pass it through X and get that ball movement flowing like your Atlas teammates. So Connor, really appreciate you joining, and get some rest before the rest of the week and going into the semifinals.
Awesome. I appreciate you guys having me on. This was fun.
And thank you so much, Shelly. Oh, always a pleasure talking to Shelly. Great insights. Appreciate him fighting through some Philly Wi-Fi and putting up with our tomfoolery, Rosie, and let's finish it up with the rest of the season's superlatives here.
You know, one question I am kind of dying to know now, based on what Connor was saying there. Somewhere, somehow, there's possibly video of Jeff Teat with the Atlas medallion breaking down dance moves in the locker room.
Now, do you think his dance moves were better than Connor's?
See, he's the kind of guy who I think goes one of two ways, right? He is either almost clinically terrible at dancing, like you're like, how is it possible that you are an athlete and also have no control over your extremities whatsoever when you're on a dance floor? Or he's a sneaky good dancer because, you know, he knows what he's doing so well as far as manipulating time and space. So like, you know, like if I told you
that is a great lacrosse breakdown of dancing.
If I told you Jeff Teat won a contest doing the robot when he was like 17 years old, it wouldn't be like totally impossible to picture that happening, right?
Listeners of the 5-minute non-releasable podcast will know what rap songs that Rosie would love Jeff Teat to be singing mic'd up, and you know, someday we might very well get it.
we will see. The less we know about Jeff Teague, the better. As an enigma.
Connor, thank you so much for joining the show. And like I mentioned, we got more season superlatives to rattle off here. Some fun categories towards the end, Rosie. Let's start off with a relatively fun one. A lot of contenders this season for quote of the year. Rosie, what is your quote of the 2025 season?
You know, we were just talking about Boston kind of having a tough go. I am going to shout out some cannons here. Quote of the year, I'm going with head coach Brian Holman, who said very early on in the season, grabs Ben Ramsey in a huddle, and he says, and I quote, "Rammer, you got number one over there? He's got 500 points for a reason. Get him the effing ball." I think that is just a fantastic quote. I think it is fantastic that, you know, he refers to his son as number one. And instead of by name, just say, you know, not Marcus or anything. It's like that guy over there, like he works in a factory and he's one of his employees. I think it's good that he didn't just ignore the fact that that guy put up 500 points. That is a big thing. Hey, dummy, rookie, D-mid, get that guy the ball. 500 points. Get him the effing ball. Way to go, Brian Holman. Congrats to you, sir.
I mentioned the O'Neal quote. I thought it was pretty savage when he said anything touches a stick, he's got to catch it. And he proceeds to go between the legs. One of my favorite quotes of the year was a segment from our, RJ Kaminsky doing the access of training camp. Tom Shriver just giving him the business with some unsavory language. And couldn't include him in the podcast or in the show as a result. And instead, it was a funny social clip. And unfortunately, Shriver and the Archers finished last place. Correlation, probably not, but maybe you need to start treating, be more open to the media, and then the Archers' downfall was in no way related to this, but it was a funny, lighthearted side of in training camp that we do love to see in those all-access vids.
And that's such a savvy veteran move. That's not a rookie move, right? Like a rookie would walk with RJ and talk to him for 4 hours and just get lost on the way to the dorms, whatever, just because RJ wants to talk to him. But Tom Shriver, savvy vet, he's not playing those games. He's like, hey, let me just unleash a swarm of expletives that you can't use, and it's all just going to be bleeped out. You know what I want to see Shriver do next year? And Tom, if you're listening to this, here's what you should do next year. Just start singing Beatles songs. Anytime RJ brings the camera over, just start singing Beatles songs, and they'll never get the rights for them because it'll cost them like $2 billion, and they'll have to get rid of all the footage.
You know, RJ will not want Tom to hear this portion. But you know, we'll mix in some serious categories in here as we go along. The next being best value pick. There's been a lot of talk about the production of the 2025 rookie class. Chris Kavanaugh, Logan McNaney, Andrew McAdory, we mentioned, and Aiden Carroll. Who's the last nominee?
McAdory, Carroll, Kavanaugh. McNaney?
I'm going to edit this anyway, but I just need to know.
Was it McNaney? Is that the fourth?
I said him.
Oh, Hilt.
Oh, of course. Yeah, you got Kavanaugh, Hilt, McNaney, Carroll. Just a loaded class this year, Rosie. But who are some of the guys that maybe slipped down? Who is the best value pick for your money, Rosie?
A lot of good value picks. This was another year where There's kind of value to be had each and every round. Not really a bad round. I'm going to give value pick of the year nomination to Carter Rice, round four, pick number five from Syracuse. It's tough being a short stick defensive midfielder. You know you're going to get just singled out and challenged whenever possible. And just kind of the ability to stay in a Redwoods lineup and just kind of hold your ground like that. You know, if you're getting these pick games that obviously you're being singled out and it just never gets easier for you. So the ability to just stay in there and start each and every game the way that he did, I would nominate him for the award.
Very good nomination, Rosie. I'll go with Mike Grace. Michael Grace, the RIT Syracuse product, lefty, big Canadian long pole. You know, I was kind of skeptical, trying to figure out what my draft grade was going to be for the New York Atlas. I think I was a little harsh on them. Didn't love the Grace pick. And man, did he prove me wrong. As a third rounder, he was an absolute snub for LS Time of the Year. Alternated some at close towards the down stretch with Brett Makar's injuries. And he's got the transition skills. He can score, he can assist. He's great off ground, he's great covering. And he's just a lot more mobile than he was maybe towards the end of his RIT career because of that knee injury. And he's going to be a great pro for a long time. So I really believe in his physique and all-around talent. So shout out Mike Grace, man. Great value pick because, you know, it's pretty easy to pick on some guys who were nominated for Rookie of the Year, but I like their nominations for that category, Rosie. Players who maybe everyone thinks we need to redraft the entire class as a category. I think there's a couple obvious nominations here, Rosie.
Yeah, I got to start with Chris Kavanaugh, right? 10th overall. Pretty much every time he's out there, he's doing something where people are like, okay, well, this is, you know, clearly a number one weapon in an offense. And he fell just so incredibly far. If you redo the draft, honestly, he probably ends up back with the Redwoods again if you redo the draft, just by nature of them having the second and third picks. But, you know, it wouldn't surprise anybody if you did the draft again and he went, you know, number two or number three. We've just seen him kind of answering any potential, I guess, skepticism that people might have had that caused him to drop a little further than, you know, some expected early on. And he has kind of, you know, he has charged head on into just opposing defenses, you know, teams trying to stop him, just the way that he's been working with that offense. So many touches. He is the central figure in that offense that obviously he's joined by guys like Dylan Malloy. There are various ways that they're scoring, but he is the one who's making it all happen and kicking off these offensive possessions.
Yeah, it'd be interesting, the butterfly effect of, all right, if you take Chris Cav second or third, who do you let slip of McAdory and Sam English, and how that kind of trickles down the rest of that midfield domino effect, the rest of that first round. I'll go with Logan McNaney, the other kind of obvious choice there, picked one slot later at 11 for Denver. Kudos to the pseudo for seeing the winning pedigree. He advanced to the national championship all 4 years as the starter for Maryland, and he is a game away from doing it again as a pro. So, McNaney, could you go even higher? I don't know what other goalie needs. You look at the other teams, California kind of being the one that stands out. But listen, as we just mentioned, they had their hands full with wanting Chris Kavanaugh and getting him later. So they had some offensive needs to cover. Speaking of the Redwoods, boy, this is a fun category, Rosie. Best equipment equipment of the 2025 season, what are you going with?
I think the best equipment has to be awarded to the magical cleats currently worn by Dylan Molloy. I mean, even if they had no backstory, it's just that they're phenomenal looking cleats. You don't see a lot made like that these days. I don't even know what kind of color they are. It's kind of like a, it's like a shiny greenish blue. Kind of looks like a beetle or something like that. I don't know what you would tell your local Home Depot to get that kind of paint made up for you. But it's a very sort of weird shiny color. And you don't see a lot in shoes, maybe in like Belgian cars or something like that. But as we know, they came from Anthony Kelly when Dylan Molloy's old shoes essentially exploded on him. And they have been working out great. And, you know, when Anthony Kelly first got them, he got them for an all-star game. So, you know, obviously he was doing something well at the time. And that very season, he went on to win a championship. So we will see if those cleats will witness another championship this season as well.
That's a very good nominee, Rosie. I'll go with the leg sleeves from a couple different players. Jared Bernhardt, whenever he wears one, shout out. Whatever's keeping those calves from being the best athlete on any given lacrosse field pretty much ever. You know, Jackson Eicher's got a really cool one. Mac O'Keefe wears a really cool one as well. And if we're staying with the shoe category, I'd venture to say Brett Dobson's like turf sneakers that he wears in the crease, pretty swaggy, and he gets a lot of kick saves with those. So I feel like they've got some extra padding in those. Shout out Brett Dobson. Best home crowd. You can really tell that these categories were put in no particular order, Rosie. Which home crowd were you most impressed with this year?
I'm going to say I was most impressed, and I might have said these guys last year too, under very different circumstances, however, but I'm still going to give it to the Utah Archers fans who turn out in full force for that Zion Bank Stadium homecoming. The second game in particular against the Denver Outlaws, it's weird to say that a team like the Archers, who were obviously back-to-back champs, would be kind of the ones fighting to try to pull off the upset of the year and not, you know, being the Titans on top. But that's where we were, right? And so it seemed kind of insurmountable, but those fans were like, we're going to give it all we got. We're going to try to get through this thing. And, you know, it was a tied game at halftime. And so, you know, you're watching this thing, and the way that the players are responding, they're trying to step it up, and it looked like they're performing, a little bit of extra fuel on them. And then the way that the crowd was going, really getting behind them, trying to will that team to victory. Did it work? No, it did not. But sometimes, you know, you don't always get that happy storybook finish to the games. But still, crowd went all out, and they really didn't give up until that final whistle. So I will shout them out probably the second year in a row.
Yeah, they definitely deserve it. And especially you hear how loud they were in the beginning of the game for their first game of that weekend against the Redwoods. That's probably when I was like most taken aback of like, wow, that's probably the most you can hear a home crowd to start a game through the broadcast. And you know, fandom is sometimes you just gotta deal with losing. They inherited the champions. They won it in the first year of the home markets in this tour based model league. You know, some years you just gotta lose and you get the number one pick and you move on and you rebuild. And if anyone can rebuild quickly, it is these Archers. So, you know, they'll be right back next year. When thinking of the best home environments, you think of Boston. They also lost both their games. Not for lack of fan support. That Harvard Stadium was rocking. San Diego was really good. And I'm going to go with the home crowd that did have the winning end result in Denver. Peter Barnes Stadium was absolutely cracking for that Atlas game. The end of it with the overtime win. Shout out Denver. Where should we go next, Rosie? Next category. Let's do the Brian Spallina, Tucker Durkin hack of the year.
Absolutely. I think the winner of that, if you want to call him a winner, certainly the guy on the receiving end is probably not, wasn't too thrilled about it at the time, but he has later commented that he didn't really think it was intentional. That's what he says. Yeah, probably agree with him. Who knows? That is going to be Graham Hossick snapping his stick over Chris Kavanaugh's noggin, just with little to no resistance. Basically, like if you're when you're a kid and you're walking through the woods or something, and you take a little tiny stick and you swing it against a giant tree, and the top half of it just goes flying off. That was pretty much what happened, and Chris Kavanaugh's head was that tree, and Graham Hossick's stick just snapped in two. And that is, I guess he was okay. It looked terrible, but I guess that's why we wear helmets, and everybody was all right. And, nobody did anything to Graham Hossick, because nobody's going to do anything to Graham Hossick. You can have a problem with it, but...
Yeah, you can say a couple words to him, but, you're not going to fight him over any dirty plays. And Chris Kavanaugh was falling a little bit towards the ground. So definitely not intentional, but it did add to some maybe angst of getting hit a lot as a Kavanaugh. And my hack of the year goes to Chris Kavanaugh. A couple weekends later, he just is getting absolutely lit up on the near sideline. Fellow rookie Levi Virch just hacking him on maybe one a little bit after the whistle. Right before it, maybe Chris Kavanaugh just turns around. He's like, just man, he goes right through him with an absolute hacksaw that might have cost them the game in that 5-game losing streak. So tough few weeks for Chris there. Of course, he is on a 3-game winning streak now and probably the rookie of the year front runner. So how the turntables. Next category, I've got to connect these two because we're talking about Chris so much. The Matt Kavanaugh of the Year award goes to...
Man, this is a very difficult category. I mean, just based on the momentum of these awards so far, I'm going to go ahead and give it to Chris Kavanaugh, perhaps my favorite of the Kavanaughs based on his first name alone. He, like we said earlier, just kind of been a pivotal member of this offense. He has kind of been, obviously without shading any of the other members who have had tremendous years as well, just been a solid offensive, very high energy, quick dodging kinds of guys, who've all kind of put things together, great draft picks, rookies who've panned out on that offense for the Redwoods. But like I've said, it's all kind of flowed through Chris Kavanaugh. He's the one getting all these touches, making everything happen. And he is the one who is getting the bulk of the attention, as evidenced by getting a stick snapped over his head. That's another reason I think maybe he wins this award as well. A little bit of merit for that sort of thing. Thank you for your sacrifice taking that shot from Graham Hossick and continuing to walk amongst us and live to tell the tale. So yeah, I'm going to give my vote for Kavanaugh of the Year to Chris Kavanaugh.
really only two candidates for this award this season, players wise, and the only player with more touches after the regular season was Pat Kavanaugh. Their stats are pretty much identical, 37 points. Pat's got a couple more one-point goals. Chris has got two more two-point goals on him. Pat Kavanaugh, coming from the Boston Cannons, running out of the box, running some lefty attack. Now he controls the offense with the best team in the league. Shout out Pat Kavanaugh for taking a lot of hits and being a QB for that Denver offense. Now, there's some other great teammates of this league. The Ryan Ambler Teammate Moment of the Year Award nominees. I'll start this category off, Rosie, going with Logan Wisnauskas. Going right into the net for Jared Bernhardt's first goal in Philly. He's like, hey, look what I got. It's your first pro goal. Remember when we were roomies in College Park? That was cool. Good moment there from Logan Wisnauskas. Shout out Ryan Ambler for being a great teammate.
I am going to give this one to Nick Wachuta of the Utah Archers. Working on the sidelines when Utah played against Carolina, he saw Mason Woodward come down and shoot a two-pointer that the refs ruled a one-pointer. But my man was on top of that iPad and got Chris Bates' attention, told him to throw the flag. Chris Bates was not planning to. He did not even have the flag with him at the time. So he was like, why, what's up? And then when he pointed out to him that it was actually a two-pointer, they went and found the flag, gave it to him, and he threw it out there in time. And it was changed to a two-pointer, and they ended up winning the game by one goal. Especially look at this season, the wins being so few and far between for the Archers. Nick Wachuta being quick to watch, not staring off into space or, you know, playing solitaire or something on that iPad during the game. He was totally locked in and focused to helping his team win, even though he wasn't in the cage. And with Dobson standing there, probably was not getting in the cage anytime soon, but he didn't give up, didn't lose focus, and helped the team win.
You know, noted, probably the most famous team manager of any of the teams, probably gets the most airtime, the Utah Archers. We will shout you out at some point. I am letting your name slip at the moment, but pretty great assist for getting that flag out of Chris Bates' backpack to win that challenge. Last funny category before we move on to our final segment, Rosie, the Kyle Bernlohr Retirement of the Year. And boy, there were a lot of them in the off season, but it's, I mean, just a guy who you were like, wait, is this guy playing? And all of a sudden, Jim Stagnita in a championship series press conference breaks the news that he will be looking for a new goalie, as Kyle Bernlohr has called it a career. There were several players who called it careers this offseason. Rosie, there's one that you reported on a little bit extensively.
Yeah, and that feels like it was several years ago, but yeah, it was just a few months back, you know. Just there's been so much going on this season that it's easy to forget. This was a completely different Redwoods Chris. This was Chris Gray, and you know, just kind of hung him up. He'd had a long year previously of flying back and forth and, you know, Zoom meetings and, you know, missing practices and getting out to, you know, Saturday games, but not being able to do the walkthroughs. And it was just a mess. And just the whole thing, it was essentially unsustainable. Even if he was like, no, I want to keep going, you just couldn't keep going the way that he was going. So made the decision to walk away, still nothing but love for the PLL and the game of lacrosse. You know, look forward to sitting back and watching as a fan and supporting his team. So, yeah, no, the retirement of the year, I'm going to say, was Chris Gray. And then kind of kicks into motion this chain of events. And who knows what the Redwoods look like, you know, if he was able to, you know, show up to more practices. You know, how do they play things differently? Everything we know about the Redwoods today is entirely different if that doesn't happen. So, yeah, I'm going to give it to Chris Gray on that one.
Big domino effect there. A couple guys who you may not remember. You probably do if you're a Chaos fan, but, like, you know, there are some big names like Dane Smith, Josh Byrne, who are playing Canadian ball over the summers now. Guys like Will Bowen, an absolute beast on defense. It kind of speaks to the next couple and last couple defensive classes coming out as rookies to reload like they've done with Jack Posey, Levi Virch. Very impressive. Remember Brian Minicus? Minnow. He had that kind of fan traveling section with him. He also retired. Cade Van Rapphorst looked up before his podcast. I was like, I forgot he retired. Shout out to those careers. Rosie, let's end on a serious note here because I think we're both losing a bit of steam playing tonight. Going into the quarterfinal week here. Which game are you most excited for? California versus Carolina or Philadelphia versus Maryland?
I am going to go let's see here. If I may quote the notorious B.I.G., I will say if I've got to choose a coast, I've got to pick the East. I'm going with the Eastern Conference battle between the Water Dogs and the Whip Snakes. Kind of the legacy game, right? You got the old two-time champions and the Whip Snakes trying to get back to where they were last year, where they, you know, had that shot in the title game. Water Dogs, been all sides of the mountain, won it. Down there at the bottom, now they're trying to get to the way back up. One thing I'm really excited about, this one in particular, CJ Kirst now playing attack. How do the Whip Snakes handle that? What do they do? Is it going to be Matt Dunn versus CJ Kirst? And that's going to be kind of the matchup there. Because, you know, you have this super, super established defensive player of the year guy in Matt Dunn. Lengthy resume, just, you know, superstar for years, going up against this guy who has, well, I think, 5 games under his belt right now, but back-to-back 6-point games, and has just kind of been a monster lately. So really kind of a clash in, you know, their ages and resumes and everything like that. And then, of course, you'll see those other guys, of course, like your Michael Sowers and your Rob Pinnells, Ajax, top to bottom. It's just going to be, I think, a really exciting matchup. Stags versus Tierney. What happens there? Yeah, no, there's just a lot I'm looking forward to in that one.
The CJ Kirst, Michael Sauer show against that Maryland defense going to be scintillating. But just a classic East Coast elitist move, Rosie, here. It's in Minnesota. You got to go with the West Conference. Carolina, obviously a West Coast team.
Sure.
Now, Redwoods Chaos, I've been saying on this podcast all season long, like, yeah, I'm so excited to see which team continues to prove me wrong, that they are not indeed in rebuild mode. Utah found out the hard way. And listen, matchups like Dylan Malloy on Jared Newman, Jack Rowlett on Chris Kavanaugh. The other end, you got some fun defensive matchups down there as well. Can Chase Erlin perform in a playoff setting? This will be key. Can T.D. Erlin do well against